Here in Southern California, a company based in Mexico is expanding north of the border. It's a chain of movie theaters, and as reporter Amy Isaacson found at one of its theaters in San Diego, it is very high-end.
When you step into Cinépolis, it doesn't look like a movie theater. Dave and Chris Litwack say it's more like a chic hotel.
It looks, you know, kind of young and hip, and it looks like a fun place to come.
I mean, from what it was, it looked like a, you know, horrible kind of movie theater to now it's modern and it's elegant.
Cinépolis has raised the bar. The lobby floors are dark hardwood. There's an art gallery. General manager Antonio Garcia points to people sipping cocktails at the bar.
We have an extensive wine menu with over 40 different wines. We also have an extensive drink list from chili mango martinis to Cinépolis Magnificent Margarita.
Small dining tables are dotted about. Sushi and fancy finger foods are made fresh in the kitchen. And you can order this all with the push of a button from your cushy, leather-powered recliner in the state-of-the-art theaters. When asked where they think the concept originated, people in the lobby have nearly as many guesses as there are flavors of popcorn on the menu.
I would guess France.
China.
Greece.
Right. It's from Europe.
Honestly, I'm not even sure.
That's Chris Litwack, Julie Brewster, and Jenny Flanagan. When Kristen Blakeman finds out Cinépolis is from Mexico, she's surprised.
Typically, things go the other way as opposed to this kind of luxury coming up here from there.
It's always been, like, even since I was a little kid, explaining to people that we don't necessarily drive burros and eat tacos every single day.
Carlos Wellman grew up in Mexico City. He's managing Cinépolis' expansion in the U.S. Cinépolis began in Mexico in the late 1940s. It's now the world's fourth largest cinema chain. Even so, Wellman says it was tough to open on this side of the border.
I mean, how are you guys going to do theaters if we invented the cinema, right?
Mexican businesses have been coming to the U.S. for years. For example, Entenmann's and Thomas's English Muffins are owned by a Mexican company. Borden Dairy Products is too. Traditionally, it's huge Mexican corporations that buy existing U.S. companies. Cinépolis is on the cusp of a new trend. Mexican companies coming to the U.S. as themselves. Enrique Hernandez is an attorney in San Diego who specializes in helping Mexicans do business in the U.S. Cinépolis is one of his clients. He says there's a new generation of Mexican businessmen eyeing the U.S. market.
The small companies of the young entrepreneurs, they say, okay, I have the vision, I have the energy, I'm not afraid of the U.S. I actually feel very comfortable in the U.S. market. I have a good product and I can be successful there.
Hernandez says many of these businessmen, like two of the Cinépolis USA partners, get graduate degrees in the U.S. Back at the movie theater, Cinépolis director Carlos Wellman says he hopes the theaters help expand people's perception of Mexico.
There are surprising companies that people aren't necessarily aware of that come from Mexico, the education, the culture, the population, and we hope that this will set a standard.
Cinépolis has identified 15 markets across the U.S. that it plans to move into. Cinépolis wants to be synonymous to film, as Thomas's is to English muffins. For NPR News, I'm Amy Isaacson in San Diego.
Amid all the market turmoil, the price of crude oil has fallen to levels not seen since last September. Yesterday, oil closed at just over $79 per barrel. But, and we know this will shock you, as NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports, prices at the gasoline pump are not falling as quickly.
Richard Sultanian says there are two main reasons why oil prices are falling.
One, the economy is much weaker than people expected. And two, the global markets are very concerned about the possibility of another financial crisis.
Sultanian, an oil industry analyst with NUS Consulting Group, says in the beginning of the year, crude oil prices were on the rise. Unrest in the Middle East put pressure on oil supplies, and traders had a more optimistic outlook about the demand for oil.
If the economy is going to grow and there's lots of money around, that means people are going to use more of everything, more copper, more silver, more oil, more gasoline. So they start to bid the price of all of that up. And I think what we've seen in the last few weeks is that all of those forecasts for growing GDP, growing economic activity, all of those have started to fall apart.
The price of crude started to dip in late spring, but in recent days it's plummeted. That's because traders have dialed back their expectations for the global demand for oil. Sultanian says slower than expected growth in the U.S. economy and an unstable stock market after the degrading of the federal government's credit rating have been a stark reality check for traders and have pushed oil prices to fall, but not necessarily gasoline prices. At a gas station in Washington, D.C., a gallon of regular costs $3.79, about 10 cents above the national average. Miss Harris lives in D.C., and she says high prices at the pump has meant filling up her new car with a lower grade of gasoline.
I switched over last week because the price of the premium is kind of high, so I just decided to go down to a lower grade to save a few dollars.
Drivers like Harris haven't seen a dramatic drop yet in gas prices, says Sarah Ladislau. She's an energy analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and she says that's because the price of crude oil is just one factor in what determines the numbers at the pump.
Crude oil prices make up about two-thirds of the price that you see of a gallon of gasoline, and the other, you know, third of that is made up by refining costs, things like distributing, marketing, and then taxes.
That other third also depends on where you buy your gas. For example, the closer to an oil refinery, the cheaper the transportation costs and the cheaper the price. John Hoffmeister, a former president of Shell Oil Company, says there's an easy way to understand how gasoline pricing works.
Up like a rocket, down like a feather.
Hoffmeister says it generally takes longer for gasoline prices to fall because local gas station owners often hedge their bets and keep their prices high even if the gas they're buying is cheaper.
People are trying to make a little money as the crude oil price drops because they haven't made much money as the crude oil price has risen.
Hoffmeister says that extra profit can be an important cushion for gas station owners, but for consumers, it means more pain at the gas pump. Hanzila Wong, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Stocks surged yesterday almost as absurdly as they had fallen the day before. They rallied after the Federal Reserve guaranteed super low interest rates through the middle of 2013, and stocks regained much of what was lost in Monday's huge plunge. In a moment, we'll talk to a big investor about the wild market swings.
Let's talk first about the housing market, since for most people, their biggest investment is their home. After Standard & Poor's downgraded U.S. credit, it then proceeded to downgrade the government-backed mortgage lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, all of which adds even more uncertainty about buying or selling a home right now. From Chicago, NPR's David Shaper reports.
Russell Zanka has quite the house he wants to sell.
You know, the wood's all original. This is all oak. Oak floor, put in 1949.
The 47-year-old anthropology professor has this three-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath vintage brick Georgian on the market. It's on a tree-lined street on Chicago's north side. Quiet, except for the cicadas this time of year.
It's just a nice, solid house.
Zanka is selling because he's getting married and will soon move into his fiancée's house. He says he's actually been thinking of selling for quite a while.
Well, really, since 2008. I kept thinking, well, next year can't be worse than this year, you know. But once we decided that we were going to get married, which was more than a year ago, that's when we started talking about what are we doing with the houses.
So Zanka put the house on the market and has a buyer. He'll hopefully close in about a month or so. Still, the troubling financial news of the last several days is making him a little nervous.
Of course, I just started thinking, what is this going to mean, you know? And I did think, I'm glad that it looks like I have this contract and it looks like I'm getting rid of this thing now, you know, rather than hearing this and having just have the house on the market and not knowing if anyone was even going to come and see it.
What worries Zanka more is what the housing market might be like a year from now when he says he and his new wife plan to start looking for a bigger house. For now, S&P's downgrade of the credit worthiness of the United States and of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac has had only one tangible impact on the housing market. It has actually pushed interest rates lower and they were already at nearly historic lows. So does that make it a good time to buy?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Ron Haddad is a senior mortgage banker with Baird and Warner Financial Services in Chicago.
The affordability for the cost of ownership is at an all-time low. Now, interest rates are so low, the prices with a lot of the properties in our area are absolutely at amazing levels. It makes sense to buy.
The president of the Chicago Association of Realtors, Babel Guzman, agrees, but...
For the person on the street, it's about jobs. So if they have job security, they're going to make that long-term investment into real estate. If they don't, and they feel, well, I feel the trend is changing, I could be downsized, I'm not seeing a lot of growth in my sector that I work in, I'm going to make a short-term decision, I'm going to continue to rent until I feel things have turned around.
Guzman says that even buyers who are in a good position right now, and sellers for that matter, might find the frenetic pace of financial news lately and the huge volatility in the markets to be too much.
They're overwhelmed. Their head is exploding, and unfortunately it's in dollar signs that are coming out of it.
Real estate experts and economists say it is really too soon to tell if the financial news of the last week or so will have any long-term impact on the housing market. But to be sure, it wasn't great to begin with and is still struggling to recover from the last housing crisis, and it doesn't need another. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
The fallout from the downgrade of the government's creditworthiness will likely go on for some time on Wall Street. The political fallout is a lot less clear. With Congress on its August recess, party leaders are lying low while they gather their rank and file and make plans for what's next. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports on congressional reactions so far to the downgrade.
Standard & Poor's was clear about why it downgraded the country's credit rating. Its statement said it, quote, reflects our view that the effectiveness, stability, and predictability of American policymaking and political institutions have weakened at a time of ongoing fiscal and economic challenges. President Obama put it this way. The government lost its AAA status.
Not so much because they doubt our ability to pay our debt if we make good decisions, but because after witnessing a month of wrangling over raising the debt ceiling, they doubted our political system's ability to act.
The very first reaction this got from members of Congress? More partisan wrangling.
I believe this is, without question, the Tea Party downgrade.
Democratic Senator John Kerry on NBC's Meet the Press.
This is the Tea Party downgrade because a minority of people in the House of Representatives countered even the will of many Republicans in the United States Senate.
I find those comments to be absolutely the most insidious thing I've ever heard.
This retort from Florida Republican Congressman Alan West on Fox News. He said of the Democrats,
they have to look at themselves and they have to understand that they are the ones that are totally to blame.
Doesn't sound like a whole lot has changed, does it? But there are those lawmakers who are thinking a little differently after the downgrade. Many weren't shocked by it, for one thing, like freshman Republican Andy Harris of Maryland.
Honestly, I wasn't very surprised because we were told that if the final deal wasn't large enough or convincing enough that we should expect a downgrade.
Harris was one of the Republicans who voted against his party's final deal because, he says, it just wasn't large enough. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid signaled the same thing, even before the downgrade, as he answered reporters' questions in a Senate hallway.
The question is, after we get this done, is there need for comprehensive deficit reduction? The answer is not only yes, but hell yes.
Reid and the other leaders in the Senate and House are appointing members of a super committee to come up with about $1.5 trillion more dollars in deficit reduction. And that's where many in Washington and on Wall Street are pinning their hopes for a brighter fiscal future. Andy Harris, that freshman Republican congressman, says Congress has got to convince the credit rating agencies that it can get a hold of runaway deficits.
You know, the silver lining to the downgrade is it'll make us face reality in Washington.
But here's the problem. Many, many economists, including the ones at S&P who downgraded the country's credit rating, say one of the keys to getting deficits under control would be to raise taxes on wealthier Americans, something most Republicans adamantly oppose. And it's not just economists who want that, says Andy Kohut, a pollster with the Pew Center for the People in the Press. The public wants a so-called balanced approach, too.
We have found, and every other poll has found, the American public saying, compromise, compromise, compromise.
So that lobs the ball directly into Congress's court. In the deal it passed just before the recess, the super committee is given extraordinary legislative powers. 12 lawmakers can come up with a plan that goes straight to the House and Senate floors for an up or down vote. No procedural trickery, no poison pills. The super committee could just be the place where lawmakers finally compromise. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, The Capitol.